Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, June 20th, 1996. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Dan Spencer, continuing his series, Ethics and the Earth. Today's session is number 4 and is entitled, Humanity in Nature, Bioregionalism and Deep Ecology. Let's listen in.
My name is Dan Spencer, and this is session number 4 of a 5-part series called Ethics and the Earth, where we've been looking at a variety of different ways of thinking about the environmental situation that confronts us at the end of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st century, and how ethically and morally we begin to envision our responses to that. I teach religion and ethics at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. One of my areas of interest and one of the areas I teach in is the whole area of ecological ethics. But this is the first time I've had a chance at Holden to work some of these sessions out with folks, and so I'm really enjoying that. If you were with us earlier in the week, on Monday and Tuesday, we were kind of laying the foundation for how to look at these issues in ethics. And we came up with a fairly simple definition, a working definition of ethics to help us through the week. Ethics being reflection on who we are and how we act in light of who we think we say we want to be and how we think we ought to act. So that ethics has to do both with character, who we are, and the virtues and qualities of that, and our actions, the duties and principles that guide that, the consequences that may come from that, and how we evaluate those in light of our values. And for people of faith, these oftentimes are religious values and spiritual values that help guide that. And the reason we talk about ecological ethics is because in the latter half of the 20th century, our situation has changed from any other period in history. For the first time, the cumulative effects of human actions are threatening the very sustainability of ecological systems to replicate and sustain themselves. And so we're confronted with a new situation that makes us begin to think differently about that. Yesterday, we looked at some of the ethical reworkings that are coming out of the Christian tradition, particularly drawing on the biblical tradition of stewardship, that human beings have a special vocation given by God to be stewards of creation, God's representatives on earth, of a good order created in creation. And that talked a lot about that is Douglas John Hall's book called The Steward, a biblical symbol of age. A book that's in both the bookstore and the library. Delightful book. Secondly, James Nash was talking about taking a somewhat different approach, saying that really, if we look at the heart of the Christian tradition in terms of ethics, love is the central part of that, and particularly neighbor love. We're to love our neighbor as ourselves. And so what does that mean in an ecological context? Can we think about neighbor in a non-human sense? Meaning other creatures, other plants, other habitats, ecosystems. What would it mean to love those, include our community and all of nature? And so we looked a little bit about that. Today, we're going to be looking at a couple different movements that are interrelated that have emerged partly in critique of traditional Western models and traditional Christian models in saying that those may be a good start, but they don't go far enough. And so we'll be looking at the model of bioregionalism that says ethics needs to be rooted solidly in where you're located, in your place there, particularly in what it's called bioregions. And we'll talk a little bit more about what we mean by that. And then deep ecology, that says that if ecological ethics is going to be successful, it's going to call for a wholesale transformation of both our individual self-awareness and consciousness and society itself. And we'll talk a little bit more about how that works. Well, let me just pause and see if there are any questions. How many folks are here for the first time this week, session here? Oh, well, we got several folks. So let me spend a couple minutes on something else that we did on day 2, just to help us understand this. Increasingly, as philosophers and theologians and ethicists are trying to talk to each other about how we should confront the environmental crisis, they are helping us to articulate different questions that need to be answered. And where we locate ourselves will help us know how we're shaping that. So 3 of them we've talked about earlier in the week is 1, what should be the primary frame of reference that we make in thinking about confronting these issues? should our response be primarily human-centered? And therefore, we're looking at what it takes to have a healthy, sustainable environment in which human community can thrive. And this, some people talk about in environmental ethics. What does it take for human beings to have clean air, productive soil, these kind of things? So what's the environment that we need? Human-centered. Traditionally, ethics in the West has operated what we call this human-centered or anthropocentric tradition. And human beings are seen as having intrinsic value or ultimate value as created by God. Everything else has usually been seen as having primarily instrumental value, the value they have to human beings. So the example we've used about that is human beings sometimes will talk about productive land and non-productive land. And what makes it productive is when it's helpful to human beings. So-called non-productive land may have very many different kinds of life on it. But if it isn't directly helpful to human beings, it's seen as non-productive. So the value is evaluated in terms of its value to human beings. What's emerged in this century particularly, and has also been the heart of many indigenous traditions, is a different way of thinking that's known sometimes as either ecocentric or biocentric. And this starts from the premise that all life has intrinsic value. And some that say that the end point of this position would say all life has equal intrinsic value. That is, every form of life has just as much right to live and flourish on this planet as human beings do. And therefore, what human beings need to do is find our appropriate niche within ecosystems rather than constantly dominating them to the detriment of other ones. And we'll see that the positions we look at today are strongly focused in a biocentric and ecocentric endpoint. Another debate that's emerged in there is the question of, should we focus primarily on individuals and the moral worth of individual creatures, whether those are human beings, animals, or so forth, or should our primary focus be on the well-being of ecosystems, the larger ecological community, and therefore there may be individuals or things like that that don't fit into that, that can be, in some extreme cases, sacrificed. But what we need to do is, and this has been the whole thing about controlling the numbers of population, focusing on the well-being and the health of ecosystems there. This, in earlier forms of ethic or human community ethics, always is a debate between how do you balance the rights of individuals with the rights or the duties to the community. But that operates also in the ecological realm. We talked a little bit, for example, people who are involved in animal rights focus on the individual concern, but from a biocentric perspective. They say that animals have intrinsic value, but they focus on the rights of individual animals and how we're treating them. Okay? Others would focus on more on the land use here. Let me give you one quick example to illustrate how people think differently about this. In the state where I'm living now, Iowa, one of the big issues right now is around factory farming of pigs, of hog farming. These large, where you can have up to 20, 30,000 hogs on a farm. Someone operating from an animal rights perspective, that is individual concern and biocentric, would oppose that primarily because it's cruel to each of the animals. To each of the individual animals, it's very cruel, and we're treating those animals as a means to an end, that is ending up on our tables. Okay? Someone from a holistic perspective might recognize that, but they say the primary concern is that kind of agriculture is not ecologically sustainable. It has very detrimental ecological effects on the river systems when you concentrate manure in those areas. It harms the land. There's a variety of ecologically damaging things. And so they might oppose it because it hurts the whole ecosystem. So you can see that depending on where people are will shape how they respond to different issues. And the last one, which becomes important for our talk today, is what kind of response should we have? Should we work primarily within the system, reforming the system, looking where it's causing problems like pollution, so forth, and make efforts to reform that? Or is the system itself the problem? And therefore, radical ecology or transformative ecology would say we need to overturn or transform the whole system. And when we looked at the stewardship approach to ethics, stewardship puts primary focus on human beings. That is, it's closer towards the anthropocentric side. It recognizes that all of life has value, but says humans have more value, are a higher form of life. But it's also holistic in the sense that we are being asked to be stewards on behalf of all of creation. So there is concern for the whole well-being, without, however, sacrificing individual rights. Biblical tradition strongly focuses on the rights of individual, but always in the context of the community. The two approaches we're going to look at today, bioregionalism and deep ecology, are located on the right side of this sheet here. That is, they're strongly biocentric, finding value in all of life and evaluating ecosystems themselves. They're strongly oriented towards a holistic perspective, the health of the ecosystems and us finding our appropriate place within them. And thirdly, they are forms of radical ecology, and that they say our current practices and our value systems are part of the problem itself, and we need to transform them. Or some people say we need to return to an earlier phase of indigenous beliefs in order to confront it. So that's what I want to say by way of background before we launch into them today. But are there questions or comments or things that aren't clear on that before we move on? Yeah?
How does the anthropocentrist see the pig farm?
Well, let me give you a couple different ways that an anthropocentric... An anthropocentric individualist, I would say, would be representative of capitalism. Because what capitalism does is it's explicitly human-centered, and everything else is seen as a resource. Animals, trees, plants, land are seen as a resource for economy, for economic development. And it's also focused on individual rights, such as private property. If I own it, I have the right to do what I want with it. So an extreme form would say, I'm sorry, that's my property, that's my business, I should be able to do what I want with it. Okay, so that would be, I would say, an anthropocentric individual concern on the pig farming. An anthropocentric holistic one might respond in one of two ways. And this is what I say is typical of stewardship. Those who would support it might say, look, the economy of Iowa depends on raising hogs. We can reform these things so we get rid of the worst abuses, but if we don't allow pig farms to develop in the factory farm, all the jobs are going to move to places like North Carolina where they're doing it. So we can't outlaw. If we outlaw it, all of our community well-being will go downhill. Iowa's economy will go downhill. We won't have the resources we need. Or on another side, from the same perspective, somebody could say, look, if we allow hog farming to come in, what we're going to lose is the family farm. And we'll lose, not only we'll lose family farmers, we'll lose the whole rural way of life. So for the well-being of human communities, we should oppose hog farming. And that would be human-centered, human communities, but more holistic, focusing on the community. So I give you a sense on some of that? Yeah. And so what I do with my students, Ashley, is I give them five different positions on the hog lot issue, starting from, I own the farm, I own the hogs, I can do whatever I want, to hogs are an introduced species to Iowa, they're not even native to North America, they're damaging our ecosystems, they shouldn't even be in the state. And then put some positions in between and help them begin to analyze it that way. What's fascinating to me, living in Iowa, is you hear every one of these positions, but usually kind of confusedly articulated. Yeah?
When you finished yesterday, you quoted an author who said that there's a billion Christians in the world, and that, what was the quote that we ought to...
Rosemary Ruther talks about the fact that there are 1 billion Christians in the world, and we have to, if we're concerned about the earth, we have to be able to express that concern that's intelligible and convincing to Christians within their own language.
But I'm shocked at the different where the Christian church is on this line. You never get the billion to...
That's a very helpful thing to remind about, because where I'm going to look today is oftentimes rooted in a critique of the stewardship tradition. And as we talked a little bit about yesterday, I would say 95% of our churches haven't even gotten to a stewardship position. That is, they haven't really thought through what ecological stewardship would look like as a faith community. And so keep in mind, I think if Christians took seriously their own tradition of stewardship, we would be about 90% of the way to resolving a lot of our problems. But I want to at least introduce you to what the critique is and what the alternative is, because you're also going to hear about this if you follow environmental issues. And I think there are some points that are raised that people of faith need to take seriously in our own traditions. Let me talk a little bit about bioregionalism. Anybody familiar with that term? Have you come across that term before? Yeah. What's your sense of what it means?
I guess I first heard about it through Gary Snyder.
Gary Snyder, yeah. I'm going to quote some of his stuff later.
And just kind of talking about the ways in which, for example, a simple example would be the state borders ought to be where they are, but they ought to be along lines of geographic.
Okay. That's a very helpful thing, that when you look at what our borders, our political boundaries are, they usually bear very little resemblance to the topographic or national boundaries. And I brought here, again, because this is the state that I'm living in right now and I teach out of this, I brought an article that has the county map of Iowa. And it's very interesting. Anybody here from Iowa?
Originally.
Any Iowans? Okay.
Now,
it's not totally illogical. There are some reasons why I came there. But let me just show you, and for those of you sitting in the back, it may be a little hard to see, but I'll explain this as I go. Here's the county map of Iowa.
Oh, no.
Right? Can you see what it looks like there? Very neat and tidy. Right? Now, do you think this has much resemblance with the natural topography of the state of Iowa? In fact, if any of you have ever flown over the Midwest, it's absolutely phenomenal because the entire Midwest and much of the country, but especially the Midwest, is a grid. Mm-hmm. All the roads. And I find it fascinating when a road runs into a lake, stops at the lake, picks up on the other side, and continues in a straight line, or runs into a hill. I mean, we have taken and superimposed a square grid oftentimes on there. Now, the counties of Iowa made a lot of sense originally because what they tried to do was divide it up into manageable units so that anybody in a county could get to the county seat and back in a day's drive. It's very logical. When you're settling there and that kind of thing, you only had to drive as far as into county, so the furthest you'd have is one day's drive in and back again. But in terms of now thinking about use of natural resources, what do you do when one county is polluting a watershed and there are three other counties that share that watershed? Okay, how do you start? So part of what bioregion is trying to do is help us to adapt human culture to natural systems rather than make natural systems adapt to human culture. Now, I mentioned that bioregionalism emerges as strongly as a critique and also deep ecology to the Christian tradition, particularly because, at least historically, Christian tradition has been strongly human-centered. And we'll see that the deep ecology sees human-centeredness as the primary source of domination of nature. So that's part of there. The wonderful side of our tradition is that it's also out of that Judeo-Christian tradition that we have things like the moral worth of individuals and human rights tradition. But it's been a strongly human-centered tradition. Secondly, throughout the majority of history, the majority of the tradition, nature has either been absent, there's very little reference to it, or passive. Sometimes nature serves, we talked earlier, as the stage on which the drama of redemption takes place. Or there's a good deal part of the tradition that sees nature as actually hostile to humanity. And so nature is seen as either absent or negative in much of this tradition, and that has contributed, many say, to the problem. Thirdly, as Christianity has developed within Western society, there has developed a very strong nature-culture split. So culture is seen as the opposite of nature. And we have cities and we have wilderness areas. We have nature and we have culture. And as a result, nature is seen as one of two ways. It's seen as either a threat to culture. And so we have to conquer nature. We conquer mountains. We subdue nature. We tame rivers. Right? So there's this whole metaphor of the way nature is a threat and we have to conquer it. Or nature is seen as kind of a passive, beneficent resource. It's always there to help us develop culture. It's Mother Nature. It provides for us. It cleans up after us. All the things that mothers are supposed to do, at least in the Leave It to Beaver model. We'll talk more about the connections between female images of nature and feminism tomorrow when we look at ecofeminism. But we've had this kind of thing. But what's clear is that nature is something what humans are not. It's either a passive resource or it's threatening. But it's not who we are. We're somehow not connected or part of this in much of the tradition. Now, we talked yesterday that much of that is a distortion of the biblical tradition, and yet I think it is the dominant understanding in many, many of our churches and in Western society. And finally, another thing that is very important is that in the one of the dominant metaphors for the Christian faith is one of journey or pilgrimage. Now, that's a powerful metaphor that speaks to many of us. But it's very different than indigenous traditions that see the primary metaphor as being rooted in a place, in a home. And so we have all, if you listen to our Christian You know, Christian hymns, "This world is not my home, I'm on a journey, Pilgrim's Progress." There's all this assumption that wherever we are is not our final resting place. We'll leave it beyond when we get to heaven, our final home. And so part of the concern is that that has contributed to, one, not understanding where we are, and secondly, not being concerned about it. So bioregionalism begins just the opposite. Right? It begins with the assumption that where we're located is our spiritual as well as our physical home. We need to know it intimately, the way we know our faith intimately. Let me read you a couple quotes that can help us get located in this here. You're going to have a chance in a minute to test your own bioregional awareness, all right? But we'll get to that in a moment here. Jim Dodge, and this is an absolutely delightful article. If any of you are interested, has an article called "Living by Faith: Some Bioregional Theory and Practice," and it's in a book that I heartily recommend called "Home: A Bioregional Reader." But he says bioregionalism is from the Greek word "bios," meaning life, and the French "region" or "region," itself from Latin "regia," territory. Etymologically, then, bioregionalism means life territory, or the place of life, or perhaps government by life. I love this next little quote here. He says, "If you can't imagine that government by life would be at least 40 billion times better than government by the Reagan administration, or by mobile oil, or by any other distant, powerful monolith, then your heart is probably no bigger than a prune pit and you probably won't have much sympathy for what follows." This was written in the late 80s during the Reagan period there. But part of what we'll see is the contrast to the large unit of governance being ruled in place here. Now, what does bioregionalism claim then? Bioregionalism says that it's actually biological realism. That is, that we've been falsely living outside the realms of biological reality or ecosystems. And we've been able to do that primarily because in this century we've discovered oil. We're going to have about 100 to 150 year period of human history in which oil is going to fuel all these artificial ways of escaping ecological boundaries. But when that runs out, what happens? And then it says, bioregionalism is simply biological realism. In natural systems, we find the physical truth of our being, the real obvious stuff, like the need for oxygen, as well as the more subtle need for moonlight, and perhaps other truths as well. Not surprisingly, then, bioregionalism holds that the health of our natural systems is directly connected to our own physical, psychic, and spiritual health as individuals and as a species. And for that reason, natural systems and their informing integrations deserve, if not utter veneration, at least our clearest attention and deepest respect. Let me outline for you at least a few of the main points and claims of bioregionalism, and then we'll have a chance to talk about what this might mean, what the implications are. As I mentioned before, a newsprint kind of guy that finds it helpful to organize my thoughts ahead of time on this. And unless you're worried, I do recycle all this paper here. In my classes at Drake, I'm still using the newsprint that I wrote up at Holden in 1992 in my biomedical class. So, okay, bioregionalism, an ethics of place. The central principle of bioregionalism is the integrity of natural systems and culture. That human culture needs to be part of natural systems, not counter to it. The belief in the natural systems provide both our physical sustenance, but also our spiritual sustenance. That our spirituality and our religion also needs to be part of and fed by natural systems there. So you get these two clear senses here. Interestingly, then, that the bioregionalism says the function of culture is to mediate the self, our individuals, and the ecosystem. The culture exists to mediate ourselves, our individuals, and the ecosystems in which we find ourselves. Now, that's very contrary to much of Western culture, which is designed to escape natural limits, to get out of them, to not have to think about them. Whether it's air conditioning, so we don't have to worry about what time of year it is, whether it's, you know, the convenience of electric appliances, automobiles, whatever. So a fundamentalist there says that bioregion says we need to adapt culture to natural rhythms and limits, when much of Western society has tried to make nature adapt to our idea of culture here. There are at least three important elements that make up bioregionalism's claims here. First of all, obviously, it's based in the notion of bioregions. And bioregions are distinct geographical or biological regions where there's a lot of interdependence of the life forms there. One, there are several ways of defining these, and there's no clear consensus, but one example is in a watershed. You can look at the Railroad Creek Valley. All of the trees and the plants and the animals in this valley are dependent on this watershed for sustenance. And so whatever we do to this watershed, such as the tailings, affects everything else in this watershed. Some people do it in terms of more geographic areas. Some people do it in terms of elevation, where all the plant, the biotic communities are similar. But the point is beginning to look at smaller discrete units of biological and geographical territory where there's a lot of interdependence between the life forms there. And says that's where we should root our ethics and root our culture. Secondly, bioregionalism is based in anarchy. Now this is the one that sends my students through the roof. And they say, whoa, anarchy, that's pretty scary. We have, I think, in our society, a deep-seated suspicion of anarchy, mostly, I'd say, because most of us have no idea what it means. We equate anarchy with chaos. But anarchy is a deep-seated, long philosophical tradition based in three primary components. One, political decentralization. So it says that you use the lowest unit, for example, Holden Village, as a political unit where we can make the majority of decisions of our lives because we live in this unit. We don't have to worry about Wenatchee or Seattle or Washington, D.C. for most of it. We make it, we're politically decentralized here. Secondly, along with that, self-determination. And this, and I think, is very close in some sense to the early New England models that talk about political decentralization, self-determination, and thirdly, social equity, that there's a fair distribution and responsibility of resources. So when they talk about anarchy, what they're talking about is self-rule and government within these distinct bioregions, recognizing that there will be some higher levels that are needed, but suspicious of giving too much power, much as our early constitution did when it designed federalism. And thirdly, the third element is spirit or spirituality. Bioregionalism is founded in profound regard for all of life, and not just human life. And it has two claims. It talks about the interconnectedness of all life, which is both ecological reality as well as a spiritual belief. And also finding spirituality in lived daily reality. Finding spiritual reality in lived daily reality. One of the things it says is simply by paying attention. Paying attention to the life process and natural resources around us in that sense, and rooting our spirituality within that, rather than a world-fleeing spirituality. I've got to read a quote here, and then we'll get you divided up in some groups to talk about a couple things here. Yeah. The Jim Dodge again says this way then in terms of bioregionalism. He says it's a decentralized, self-determined mode of social organization, a culture predicated upon biological integrities and acting in respectful accord, and a society which honors and abets the spiritual development of its members. In that sense, you can say that in some ways, bioregionalism is the antithesis to our current structure, which encourages not spiritual maturity, but consumerism, individualism, those kinds of things, and is increasingly mass culture rather than respecting the individuality of different regions and so forth. Two main areas of bioregional practice. One, it emphasizes the local level. Act where you're located. Get to know your own bioregion. It's partly oriented in resistance, that is, resisting further destruction of natural systems. So whatever we can do to resist further destruction of the natural system. And secondly, in renewal, trying to renew degraded parts of nature and seeing our own well-being as tied up to that. Questions or comments on that very quick overview about how bioregionalism orients itself? Yeah.
Is it seems to me that the bioregionalism would be no cities as we know them today. It might be completely different.
Well, and then that's a big challenge there. Again, we'll especially see that in deep ecology. Deep ecology would agree with you because they're very suspicious. There are many bioregionalists who say, no, cities could still be part of this, but cities would be much more dependent on their local bioregion. The people in the cities would be fed primarily by the plants in there. There'd be much more careful attention to the flow of water resources, those kinds of things. So you wouldn't simply transport your own garbage elsewhere. I remember an example of this when I was living in New York. And New York, since it takes all its barge, trash and garbage and tosses away and puts it on barges, and they were sending it out and dumping it in the sea. That got forbidden, and so they put it on a barge. Any of you remember this? And they put this barge to sea, and they couldn't find any place where they could land it. Uh-huh. And would you remember where it eventually ended up? Some of it came back, and one of the ships, some of them increasingly were being taken in by poor countries. Haiti, yes. Puerto Rico, Mexico, countries that are so poor that they're willing to absorb the garbage of the first world in order to earn a little money so that people can live. And so poor Haitians are living with the toxic waste of North Americans. But that's the opposite of a bioregional perspective that says we should have the flow of resources stay within bioregions as much as possible and adapt our culture that way. Let's take about 5 or 10 minutes to do kind of a fun little thing here. And this is, I'm going to get you in pairs on this one here, so that'll help you out. It gives you two minds to try and answer this. This is called Where Are You At? A bioregional quiz. So I'd like to, in pairs, if each of you would take one of these sheets here. And this is a little self-testing score, self-scoring test here. Think about the home area. And don't count Holden Village here. Holden, it makes it too easy because Holden's a little more bioregionally aware. But think about the home area where you live, or where, perhaps where you grew up. One of those folks over there. And see how many of these questions you can answer here. We'll give you about 5 minutes for this, so not a lot of time, but just to read through them. There should be enough for one for every two people. So you see, if you just pair off with somebody. You need one back here? So, what's your sense? How'd you all do?
Horrible,
great.
Horrible, great, in between?
Great.
How'd you like the self-scoring criteria at the bottom there? I did this test with my environmental ethics class. And these were the students who are the most astute students I have in terms of environmental issues. So they can tell you anything about the ozone layer. They can tell you anything about global warming. They can tell you about the rainforest. So I asked them to tell me about Iowa, where we're living and working and stuff. We did this little test. Boy, were we chagrined at the end of that. What's your response? It sounds like some of you were able to do quite well.
I think we did.
Tell them about when was the last time a fire came through your area. I thought you had an ingenious answer to that one.
You weren't supposed to be listening. I said the last time I had one in my fireplace.
That was quite ingenious. Though.
Yeah. We haven't actually seen the moon for about almost a year now. So.
Where do you live?
Seattle.
Okay. Did anybody see it last night?
Yeah.
If you're out walking last night, I found it's really interesting. Occasionally comes out.
Came on the right day.
I found that the year I spent in year-long community here in 83-84 at Holden was wonderful because I was able to learn a lot of things that are on this question here because it's small enough, you're close enough to the seasons, you notice when the moon's changing, all those kinds of things. But it's so easy to get out of sync of those in other places. Other responses people had from working through this.
Things is that it's hard, we can name, for instance, grasses and plants. It's real hard to know what is native.
Yes.
I said,
I'm not sure a lot of people know.
Virtually always, if you need an edible one, you can name dandelion, but that's not native to North America. That's an import.
From where did it come from?
Dead Europe.
What is the meaning of
Anybody, what is the meaning of the major plant associations region? We got any botanists or biologists in the room? A lot of times, this is one of the ways that people group bioregions. As you can say, for example, if you live in the Douglas fir zone, what are the plants that are associated with that zone? Or I live in a prairie, in a prairie zone, although there's virtually no prairie left in Iowa. But what is the plant associations in a prairie zone? If you were in a desert, in the saguaro cactus area, what are the plant associations? How are they interdependent? Which ones, you know, depend on others? Which ones are edible, which ones not?
Hardwood versus...
All those kinds of things. So you could begin pinyon pine forest zone, those kinds of things there.
Number eight was easy.
What was number eight?
Yes.
Well, what's the question? What soil series are we standing on here? Anybody know?
What?
What soil series we're standing on here at Holden Village? Pardon? Glacial till, all right? Holden, I guess, a good place if you know that glaciers are the most recent episode for shaping this valley, and glacial till is what's left behind. Well, what does this have to do with ethics? That's the last part of the question here. And bioregionalism says it has everything to do with it. Let me just read you a little quote that Gary Snyder, you mentioned Gary Snyder before. I think this is a wonderful thing. He says, bioregional awareness teaches us in specific ways. It's not enough to just love nature or to want to be in harmony with the earth. Our relation to the natural world takes place in place, and it must be grounded in information and experience. And I think that I've been doing a lot of work in my own stuff about what I'm calling ecological location. In ethics and other areas, we have this fancy word called social location. Where you're raised with respect to society in terms of your class, your gender, your race, your geography, those kind of things tell you a lot about how you see the world. But we rarely pay attention to how we've been shaped to see the world from where we live. This came home to me in a very direct way because I grew up in the West Coast, went to college in Minnesota. Got to Minnesota when I was 18, and it was the first time I'd ever been any place that didn't have mountains. It's like, how do people know where they are? Really? How do you know where you are when there are mountains to look up to and say, oh yeah, there's the mountains, that's the north, you know, and that's the west. I mean, I was so disoriented. And the point that people make is that we learn to know nature in concrete, specific ways. If you grew up along the ocean, you learn the sound of the ocean, the smell of the sea. If you grew up in the mountains, one thing. If you grew up in the desert. And so if we're thinking about our sensitivity, it's not to simply the earth and the abstract, but to particular places. And yet we need to know those places and their rhythms. Because that's what bioregion says. If we're going to successfully confront ecological issues, we need to know where we're at. And that's sort of the other thoughts or comments or responses that came up in your conversations on any of this.
And we were talking about that he's in Baltimore right now. And when you're in a city, it's really difficult to know what your bioregion is. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I'm out in the desert in a very rural area, and it's easier for me because it's right there. But when you're in a city, and it's so drastically changed, you know, a lot of those questions are very difficult.
They are very difficult. Did you notice they say it'll be easier if you're a rural person? Rural people tend to be known like this. The other thing they point out is that we think of this in some ways as kind of newfangled, but he points out that for 99.9% of human history, virtually every human being had this information. Your livelihood, your ability to live depended on it. People were bioregional by and large until the rise of the city-state. And that's when things began to shift a little bit. That's also when a lot of our ecological problems really developed. There, Reinhold Niebuhr and some others have had a wonderful term that within each increase in technology, they talk about as the fall upward. It brings great potential positive benefit, but it also increases the positive potential for negative consequences. And the rise of the city-state brought all sorts of possible potential positive things, but it also began to bring in ecological problems. Let me just mention a few, though. Go ahead, yeah.
Well, I was just going to comment on that it almost sounds like, well, if everyone just moved out in the country, then everything would be fine. Mm-hmm. But I think with our population level, what it is now, it wouldn't be fine. No. I mean, they didn't have the population we do now.
Let me ask this question. Any of you particularly who come from city areas, can you think of ways that your cities in the last 10 or 15 years are becoming more bioregionally sensitive?
Recycling.
Recycling is certainly one, okay.
And the flood in Rochester, there's been a whole project of, you know, flood.
Okay, cities that are on rivers, have you got to pay attention? You can't build willy-nilly on floodplains, that there is a natural flow that has to be protected there. I've really seen that in Iowa in the last 3 years because of the flooding we've had there. All right, yeah.
You can't build willy-nilly on earthquake calls either. We're finding that out.
Yeah, people on earthquake calls from California up to Washington, British Columbia, are finding that out. I still see plenty of examples of not paying attention. I was astonished when I have a sister who lives in Tucson in the Southwest. And I'm just astonished with all the new housing developments that they insist on putting in water-based lawns in an area that has water crisis. And that's an example of not being bioregionally sensitive. You've got all this beautiful cactus and desert flora that you could do wonderful things with, but they insist on golf courses, green lawns. And the whole point of bioregionalism is so much of our problem is that our earliest ancestors, those of us who come from European immigrants, brought with them European ways. They make sense in some parts of North America. They don't make sense in a lot of parts of North America, and yet we kind of insist on having that suburban model that follows a particular thing. Example of non-bioregional perspective. But I think there are ways to make our cities more bioregional by paying attention to them. Yeah.
Well, another example of that, don't go to Las Vegas. Their housing developments are just acre and mile and mile, but the significant thing there is that if we went by ones that were still in the framing state, they're all stick buildings. I mean, where that has to be imported from.
My sister Martha, who's up in the balcony, has been involved in an alternative to that in terms of the hay bale and the straw bale houses, which was involved on the prairie where there weren't trees. It was a real good recyclable resource you could build houses out of. There, but your thing there is a perfect example of anthropocentric individual kind of thinking. Human-centered only, the rest is resource, and it's whatever I want. If I can afford to pay for it, I get it. That kind of thinking. That's what drives so much of our thing, rather than thinking much more clearly. Well, let me just introduce a few things on deep ecology, and then we'll spend the rest of time in discussion, because deep ecology is related to this bioregionalism, but has a little bit different sense. You sometimes hear about it, so I want you at least to know what we're talking about when we talk about deep ecology. And I can move it over to the central board here, because some of you may have problems seeing it here. When folks hear about deep ecology, what comes to mind? Pardon?
I said water.
Water, all right. What's the contrast to deep ecology? It's not terribly flattering, actually.
Superficial
or shallow ecology, right? That's what they're contrasting to. They're saying shallow ecology or reform ecology accepts the basic social economic paradigm and says, how do we reform this? How do we have better pollution laws? How do we have this kind of things? Without recognizing that the paradigm itself is the problem. And so deep ecology takes a step back and says, before we start tinkering with the system, we have to rethink our fundamental assumptions about who we are and our place in the world. So deep ecology says the root of the ecological problem is anthropocentrism, or human-centeredness. Always starting with our own needs or wants or desires, and then looking elsewhere. It says anthropocentrism or human-centeredness leads to the domination of nature, which is the problem. The primary need, then, is a transformation of consciousness. And the way deep ecology proposes to do this is to get away from thinking of ourselves as individual egos, individual selves, and think of ourselves as all part of much, much larger nature. And that's why it's called in terms of nature as self. So it calls for, what I've got listed here is a new psychology or the expanded self, that each of us are part of one much larger object, which is nature. And therefore, you can't think of me versus them, or a subject-object split, but rather expand our psychological identification so that those trees, those birds, everything are as much a part of me as my skin here, expanding that self. So this transformation of consciousness is what deep ecology calls for. And I've just listed here some of the main elements that you'll hear about. You'll see some of these we've talked about before. It's a metaphysics. Anybody want to give us a sense of what a metaphysics is when we talk about metaphysics? I know I can call on Michael if need be here. Anybody else have a sense of what we talk about metaphysics? It's one of those fancy words that you have to learn in school and then you probably forget. But
it's above the physical.
the overall, the meta, the how everything hangs together. All right, physics is all the little particles, anything about metaphysics is the overall assumptions we have about things. And this is based very much on what they call a metaphysics of interconnectedness, that everything from the molecular level to the galaxy level is interconnected and therefore influences each other. So we're all interconnected and all with all plants and animals and things. So it starts from an assumption of interconnectedness. If everything is interconnectedness, then to separate things into subjects and objects is a false way of looking at the world. We need to recognize that we're all part of a much larger whole. Have any of you heard of the Gaia hypothesis? Gaia hypothesis is the belief that the Earth itself is a single organism with its own life rhythms, and we participate in it and we damage that, but we're all part of a much larger whole. And so this new psychology that rejects the subject-object split or the individual ego, individual autonomy, and sees us as much all part of a larger thing. Science is seen as both based in interconnectedness and participation in that. Fundamental thing is that nature knows best. A lot like bioregionalism, we adapt our culture to nature rather than making nature adapt to it. And therefore, you minimize human disruption of nature, work with and not against nature. One of the very controversial things of deep ecology is it says we have already exceeded the planet's optimum human caring capacity. It recognizes that as human numbers go up, and we talked yesterday, remember the numbers in 1900, 1.6 billion people on Earth, by the year 2000, 6.1 billion. Just reverse those numbers, four times as many, roughly. But that as we exceed human caring capacity, keeps going up, we are eliminating of many other forms of life, extinguishing species. And so if you start with biocentrism, that all forms of life have a right to flourish and be on Earth, our expanding numbers are eliminating that possibility. Therefore, it says we need a drastic reduction both in the actual numbers and the population rate. Now, most deep ecologists say we have to do that in humane ways. They're not calling for genocide. But they're saying folks like zero population growth and others saying we've got to stop immediately, slow it down, and then begin to reduce it so that the carrying capacity of the Earth can readjust to numbers. Calls for a steady state economy. Now, the one thing you will never hear a Democrat and a Republican disagree on is that growth is good. Fundamental premise of our society, economic growth is good. Everybody thinks about that. Ecologically, it's disastrous. It's non-sustainable. It's devouring resources. And so we need to rethink how we think about it. And one of the ways they talk about it is that the economy is always a subset of the ecology. That economy is the way resources flow in the human community, but that's part, it's within the larger, what some people call the great economy or the world, which is the flow of resources throughout the ecosystems. And as our economy keeps growing, it keeps eating away at the sustainability of ecology. So how do we rethink steady state economy? Like bioregionalism, it calls for local autonomy and decentralization. Deep ecology is particularly enamored with the model of human society based on hunter-gatherer models before the rise of the city-state. Some people say that's totally unrealistic today. Others say if we're ever going to readapt to ecology, we've got to get back to sustainable units of human population, but that's, they call for a local economy and decentralization. And I think most deep ecologists would say that the city is an ecological disaster. We can't have cities any longer. We gotta move away from them. Many bioregionists would say, no, we can adapt cities to bioregions, but we have to be careful on how we think about that. And then finally, deep ecology explicitly says, like bioregionism, that religion and spirituality should be nature-based, based on the circle of life, and they'll particularly look at indigenous traditions that they're gonna. Incidentally, this is one of the reasons why there are some conservative Christian groups who oppose movies like The Lion King, which talks about the circle of life as an important part of it, because they see them as pagan, they see them as anti-Christian, they see them as, you know, if you celebrate the circle of life, you are opposed to Christianity. So that's at least some of the different ideas and assumptions about why these groups are concerned with continuing a Christian model and think we need an alternative. What's some of your own feedback or thoughts on some of this? Up there.
Yeah,
I love the environment and everything, and I know a lot of people here also respect it, but how are we supposed to take, like, cities where there's maybe, I don't know, 20% of the population cares about the environment, but the rest doesn't? How are we supposed to take all these big thinkers and thinking, okay, we need to take away these big farms, take away cities, recycle everything, I mean, that's just...
Well, bioregionalists would say act where you're located. If you live in a city, work within a neighborhood. There's all sorts of, we haven't talked about one of the issues that's a very current one called environmental racism, which is not only do we send our garbage overseas, we send to located and poor people's community and communities, and particularly communities of color in this country. So there's a lot of struggles to make life sustainable within cities, which have an inordinate concentration of other people's waste. If you live in rural areas, get in, you know, think about how to get involved in more ecologically zoning there. But they would say start locally with an overall awareness, but act where you're at and get involved. You're right, though. There are enormous problems. One of the critiques of bioregionalism is it doesn't have enough of a global act into it. You know, you can't just act locally and expect the ozone problem to go away. There has to be some level of international cooperation. But on the other hand, locally is where most of us can make an impact. We can show up at zoning meetings, and we can show up at county, you know, and talk to our county officials and those things. And 90% of the decision of the actions that have either beneficial or harmful things on the earth happen at a local level. That's what we're seeing in Iowa right now, because what's happening is there are national companies coming in to run these hog farms. So it's not even local Iowans who are really benefiting from them. The money's coming from elsewhere and going out of the state, and it's impoverishing the rural areas of Iowa as a result. Yeah.
I'm a gentleman farmer in Minnesota, so in my span of years, 50 years, everything's changed. Before, in Minnesota and in Iowa, 160 acres, you could have a family there that would run the farm, they'd have their cows and their pigs and everything, and they could make a living and do well on it. Now, if you don't have 1,000, you know this, 1,000 or 1,500 acres, forget it. And this has all been promoted by the government.
Yep.
Because I always used to think the Secretary of the Agriculture should be called the Secretary of the Consumer, because everything that the government has done has been to promote cheap food, which is the goal. And because it's been kept so cheap in that way, it is no longer possible for a farmer to make a living on 100 acres or 160, so he has gone into the big city, and in South Dakota, North Dakota, there's, you know the story. 2% of the people in the United States are farmers that produce 120% of the food for the world, and they send 20%. They send it to China and all over.
And we've ended up subsidizing corporate farming, agribusiness,
right?
Which has terrible ecologic effects. And we have, and if you look at where a dollar spent on food goes, less than 10% goes to the actual raising of the food. Most of it goes to packaging, promoting, advertising. There's a huge amount in the whole middle structure of that. And so those who are actually trying to raise food can't sustain themselves. So we bring agribusiness in for that. And most of our food money goes into packaging, transportation, into enormous. I don't know if any of you saw the whole thing when the cereal companies finally cut their prices 20 or 30%, because they were spending so much on promotion stuff, and you're getting $5 boxes of cereal.
Yeah.
It's just a crazy. But that's the whole point. We have such a skewed system in terms of our values that it has forced out those who want to farm sustainably, can't do it anymore. It's a real problem. Yeah.
When did the first book on zero population growth that came out early?
Well, the planet of Rome,
Population Bomb.
Club of Rome, okay, and the Population Bomb. There were a bunch of them that came out in the early '70s, late '60s, early '70s, where we went on cluster these. What really got the environmental movement was Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, came out in the early '60s, and then that set off a whole wave of beginning to look at these things.
But we've been focused on that to some extent in the population for, let's say, 35 years or 30 years. Has there been any slowdown of the...
Mixed. My colleague Jim Martin Schramm, who teaches at Luther College and does some teaches up here from time to time, has really studied this quite intensely. And there are some places where there have been real positive success, and the other places where it's wildly out of control. What they have found, though, is that you cannot address population growth without meeting social needs. Population growth and poverty are so closely linked, and when you have impoverished people with non-working economics, that's where you have population growth that gets out of hand, and that's why so much of it happens in the two-thirds world. Where they've been able to get relative degrees of economic security and some degree of, and people feel secure, they're able to stabilize population. Of course, we have such short memories. That's historically what happened to us as well. Why do you think so many people emigrated from Europe to North America? We all know we had poor immigrants, right? But they also had huge families. Look back, if you go back two or three or four generations to your own, huge families. Well, we had the same thing. When you have economic insecurity, you have huge families, and that happened in Europe. Europe was able to go through the Industrial Revolution, stabilize itself, as was North America. So we've seen our population rates drop because we have relative economic security. In countries where they haven't been able, it's called the demographic transition, where they haven't been able to make that, you see widespread poverty and widespread economic growth, and then also widespread ecological devastation. So I would say it's mixed, but I think that the Cairo conference was very promising in the sense they really recognize this close link. What's very discouraging for me is that the widespread now, what we call a neoliberal economic model, that is that capitalism now is seen as the only answer, and so we're seeing capitalist economics spreading across the globe with really devastating results in two areas, for social justice. It really destroys local cultures and impoverishes people. You have a wealthy elite who do very well. 10 to 15% of the population are going to really explode and benefit. The majority do very poorly. It also has terrible ecologic consequences. And I just took a group of Drake students to southern Mexico where we looked at these issues in Chiapas and elsewhere. We can take maybe one more question. I think we're at the end of our time here. But I know, did you have a hand, or is there someone in this area?
Well, I don't know if this interests anyone else, but I can't help but think of the spirituality aspect of the nature-based circle of life. It seems like in the European Christian culture in this country, there's a detachment and a denial of death.
Very much, yeah.
And that, to me, is really a big influence on how we view.
We were talking a little bit this last week in our biomedical ethics that about 90% of our healthcare dollars goes to sustain the last 2 years of life. We were so death avoiding what happens to the quality of life in that. But we don't really see ourselves as part of a circle of life. And it's very ironic for a tradition that sees death as release to eternal life that we've turned that into such a fear-based culture of death, but we don't see death as a natural part of the cycle very much. And that's, again, when we talk about the transformation of cultural and religious values, I think one of the places we need to start. We need to stop for today. Our last session tomorrow, we'll take a look at the way it's called ecofeminism, and I'll start with about a 35-minute video that talks about ways women's issues and ecological issues are coming together, some very exciting ways, and then we'll use that to talk further about some of the questions that come up. But thanks very much for coming on such a beautiful afternoon.